Look closely at the Pacific Ocean on a world globe. The first thing I wonder about is, how did people manage to populate such far-flung islands so many centuries before jet travel and modern communication? Researchers and explorers have had their theories over the years. The editor of the Harvard Review has been looking into this. She's examined everything from the oral histories Polynesians have passed down to the journals of Captain Cook to the recent accomplishments of the Polynesian Voyaging Society. And now, there's DNA evidence to help piece together the puzzle of Polynesia. Christina Thompson explores it all in her book, Sea People. Christina, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So what is this puzzle, the complete title of your book, Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia?
Well, the puzzle is that when Europeans or outsiders first arrived in the Pacific way back centuries ago, they found all these little tiny islands, which were very far apart from one another and very far away from everything else, very far away from the continental edges of the Pacific. And they found that almost all of these islands, all the habitable islands, were in fact inhabited by people. And so it dawned on them fairly early that there was this question, who were these people? Where had they come from? And of course, you know, how did they get there? So that was the puzzle of Polynesia.
And Polynesia is vast. I mean, in your book, you've got a map and it shows the Polynesian Triangle. And it goes from New Zealand to Hawaii all the way to Easter Island. And these islands are just tiny specks if you were flying over it. I mean, it's remarkable that they would have something in common. Is this one culture? Is there some way that we can surmise that they all came from the same place?
Yes. Well, that's the other part of the puzzle. So they found that there were all these people on all these islands, and the islands were far apart, and they were hard to get to, and nobody knew anything about where these people had come from. Some people imagine that they had been created in the islands by God because it was so improbable that they should be there. But the other thing that happened was that, and this is really Captain Cook, this is in the 18th century, when Europeans, they had a hard time understanding the Pacific. They didn't have very good navigational skills, and they sailed across it and got lost a lot. And then towards the 18th century, they got better at it, and Cook was the great geographer, the great navigator of the Pacific in that period. And he visited a very large number of the islands in Polynesia. So he was in New Zealand. He was in Tahiti. He was in the Hawaiian Islands. He discovered the Hawaiian Islands. Well, for the European world, that is. He was in the Marquesas. He was at Easter. So it dawned on him that these people were remarkably similar. But once he began to see the similarities among the people, it started to become clear to everybody that it wasn't just that there were all these people, they were all the same people.
What indicated to him that they were similar?
Well, so one of the things that happened was that he sailed into the Pacific originally to observe the transit of Venus on the island of Tahiti. So the transit of Venus is when the planet Venus passes across the face of the sun. And in the 18th century, astronomers believed that if they could get it accurately measured, it would help them determine the distance between the Earth and the sun, for example. So his assignment was go out there and make these astronomical observations, which he did. And then he was there for quite a while, and he got to know some Tahitians a little bit. And there was a man named Tupaia, who was a priest, I guess is what you'd call him. He was a man of knowledge. He knew a lot of things. He was a navigator. He knew about genealogies. He knew the history. He knew the stars. He knew all these things. And he asked Cook if he could go with him when Cook left. And so he did. He joined the Endeavor, which is kind of an amazing thing to have done. This is 1769. And he sailed with Cook on the next leg of Cook's journey, which took him to New Zealand. And when they got there, this is 2,500 miles away, but took them months because they were zigzagging back and forth. And when he got there, it turned out that Tupaia could speak to the Maori, which meant that they shared a common language. And nobody was expecting that. That was a really kind of, you know, mind-bending moment.
And that connection would have gone back likely centuries before that.
Oh, yes. So it turns out, you see, that all these people spoke versions of this language. The people in Hawaii's language was similar to the people in Easter Island, to the people in Tonga, to the people in Samoa, to the people in Tahiti. So that was a really important piece of evidence that these people were all related and that their pathway into the Pacific followed some common trail.
When I look at your charts in your book, I see there's the Polynesian Triangle and the Society Islands and Tahiti make it. Easter Islands makes it, Samoa, New Zealand, Hawaii, but not Fiji. Fiji is part of Melanesia, which looks to me like it's culturally part of Indonesia. And then Micronesia is a different swath of island cultures beyond that. Am I understanding these charts right, that these are indicating that while the islands are disparate, the people have a cultural common denominator? And even though Fiji is just a little bit away from Samoa on the map, it's a different culture.
Yes. One of the things that's kind of confusing about the Pacific in these culture areas, so this area called Melanesia, which would include Papua New Guinea and reach all the way over to Fiji, that western part of the Pacific, north of Australia, mm-hmm. that area is a very complicated area. It has a very old history, very complex history, lots of different peoples, very long period of time of settlement. Whereas the Polynesian area, which is this triangle, which is Hawaii, New Zealand, Easter Island, and all the islands inside there, their history is only maybe 3,500 years at the most, only 1,000 years probably in the Pacific in the eastern part. So it's a kind of a different story, and it's a little complicated because it looks like it should be the same story, but it's not.
You're married to a Maori man from New Zealand, right?
I am. That's true. But the funny thing about my husband is that when he travels in the Pacific, and we do travel as much as we can in the Pacific, he is mistaken for a local everywhere. So we were in Tahiti last year, and everyone thought he was Tahitian until he opened his mouth because he doesn't speak French.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Christina Thompson. She's the author of Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia. Christina also edits the Harvard Review Online, and her website is christinathompson.net. Christina, when we're talking about sea people, it's just hard for me to get my brain around that 1,000 years ago, they didn't have writing, they didn't have metal tools, but they were kind of aware of each other, or they had some common cultural threads. Was there trade? Was there communication? Were they completely isolated? What is your best bet of before any contact with Western civilization, did they know about each other?
So that's a really interesting question. I think what most people believe is that they're kind of in spheres of interaction. So, for example, in the center of the Pacific, right in the middle, is the Society Islands, and that includes Tahiti and a bunch of Bora Bora and Moorea and some other islands people might have heard of. Also a string, a long string of atolls in the Tuamotus, and then the Marquesas, which are just sort of to the northeast. Those islands, I think there was a lot of interaction there, a lot of traffic between those groups, especially the Tuamotus and Tahiti, but probably they didn't know that people were in New Zealand. I mean, once the groups broke off and went to their islands, there was nobody knows how much return voyaging there was. There clearly was some return voyaging, but then it seems to have been over by the time that Europeans arrived in the Pacific. The great age of kind of real transoceanic travel seems to have been over.
So return voyage, that's a whole different concept. In other words, they could get a one-way ticket venturing out and finding a new world for their clan. That's one thing, but then going back to where they came, that's a whole nother thing.
Right, right. And a lot of the arguments have focused, especially in the 20th century, a lot of the arguments focused on whether or not there had been return voyaging, whether or not these people had just kind of been blown out to these places and landed in these islands and set up a new life and lived there, or whether they had traveled back and forth. And it seems pretty clear that there was travel back and forth, especially to places like you might say, between Tahiti and Hawaii. There's a lot of legendary material that suggests that there was travel back and forth. And that's a long trip.
Oh, yeah. I mean, from Bora Bora to Tahiti, you can almost see each other, I suppose. But
not quite, but
I mean, you could know that there would be birds or things floating in the water or an indication that there's another island out there, I suppose.
Exactly, exactly.
So is there anything physical that gives us a little bit of their, I was going to say history, but it's prehistory, right? It's before anything was written. Is there anything physical that we can look at as travelers?
Yes, there's a lot of stonework in the Pacific. And one of the things that's interesting is to compare how the stonework is different in different islands. You know, the monuments of Easter Island are obviously the kind of paramount example.
Those are the famous ones.
Yeah, those are the famous ones. But there are stone sculptures in the Marquesas. And then there is stonework. There are walls and platforms and structures and so forth in most of the other islands.
Are we able to date this, and how far back does it go?
Right. So, well, the stone you can't really date, but the shell is dateable and the bones, of course. There's also a little bit of pottery, a tiny, tiny bit of pottery, which is kind of weird because the people of the Eastern Pacific are kind of considered to not have pottery, but there is a little. Hmm. The dates also have been, you know, something people have thought about and both thought and fought about. The most recent dates have been moving kind of forward so that this seems like the settlement was a little bit more recent than they had thought maybe 50 or 100 years ago.
So, I mean, are we talking hundreds of years or thousands of years?
About 1,000 years, probably. So the dates for the settlement of New Zealand, the last one is considered to be around 1200 AD. And Hawaii is sort of around the 1,000 mark. Uh-huh. Probably the society is a little earlier. But if you go over to Samoa and Tonga, those islands were settled more like 2,500, maybe 3,500 in some cases years ago. So much older on the western side of the triangle.
Indicating the other
islands were populated from
that original settlement.
Correct. That's the direction from which the settlers came. Mm-hmm. And they arrived in those western parts of Polynesia earlier, and then they stayed there for a while. There seems to have been a bit of a pause. And then they sort of propagated out to the eastern and the more remote areas.
Christina Thompson is our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She investigates the different explanations that have risen over the years to explain how people came to live on the most remote islands in the world. She's the author of Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia. Her book won a number of prestigious awards, including the Australian Prime Minister's Literary Award in 2020. Christina's first book, in 2008, tackles the history of her Maori husband's home in New Zealand and their cross-cultural marriage. It's called Come On Shore, and We Will Kill and Eat You All. We have links to Christina's work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So, Christina, let's talk about the sudden awareness in the Western world of these sea people in Polynesia. And what was that like when Europeans first connected with Polynesian cultures? Where did that happen, and what impact did that have on Polynesia?
The very earliest discovery was in 1595, so it was really a long time ago, and it was a Spaniard, and he found the Marquesas. And the thing they said about the Marquesas was that the people there were the most beautiful people they had ever seen. But most of the early interactions between Polynesians and Europeans were not really all that happy. Often the Europeans killed several of the Polynesians. And, you know, sometimes it went better and sometimes it went worse. But the long-term effect of this arrival of strange people in Polynesia was kind of tough on Polynesians. Not only did they suffer from some of these kind of more violent encounters, but they also were, of course, exposed to diseases that they were not really prepared for, that they had no immunity to.
Like Native Americans, that was a...
Like Native Americans, exactly. So, you know, Polynesians, especially in the 19th century, once the Age of Exploration was really over and what you had was a lot of whaling in the Pacific and a lot of other kinds of trading going on. Missionaries arrived. All these outsiders, and the whalers brought a hugely international crews. I mean, people from all over the world, all ports, you know, and they brought a lot of disease into the Pacific. So that was tough. There were epidemics.
The British must have connected with the Hawaiians in some kind of a positive way because they ended up putting the Union Jack on their flag and sending some of their royalty to England to study. Was that just under duress?
I think that the Polynesians, okay, so it is complicated that what happens in the 19th century, that the Polynesians take on a lot of European characteristics. They learned to read really fast. They liked the clothing. They absorbed many new foods, different animals. You know, they became a kind of acculturated to Western, to Western sort of norms very quickly and quite enthusiastically. So it certainly wasn't an all bad thing at all. It's just that they were particularly succumbed to the diseases, and that was hard.
It must have been very tough. Now, if you're a traveler and you want to sightsee and actually see artifacts and learn about this, where do you go? What's a good museum?
Oh, there's so many wonderful places. The Bishop Museum in Honolulu is an absolutely fabulous place. So that's a great place. There are little museums scattered about in various parts in some of the smaller islands, which I always recommend people go to because they're very interesting. They can be very small.
Mm-hmm.
I went to one on the island of Raiatea, and there's one on Huahine in Tahiti. So they're great little tiny museums all over.
Did they have a situation where, you know, colonial powers, imperial powers would come and basically just loot the country of its heritage and take it back to the Smithsonian Institute or the British Museum or something like that? Because a lot of times in my travels, I go to a distant land and I kind of go, where's your patrimony? It's in Berlin, or it's in Paris, or it's in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, you know, there are some Easter Island statues in Britain. That's one. And there are feather capes. There is a lot of Maori stuff in various parts of the world, in Germany, in Britain, all over the museums of natural history and places like that in the United States. So there's a lot of it spread around.
There's a new museum in Vienna, which is completely dedicated to the souvenirs picked up by the Habsburgs as they traveled the world, and the same thing in London. And, you know, it's a little bit imperialistic, but if you're a sightseer, it's easier to go to Vienna maybe than to the Marquesas. And actually, as you're traveling Europe or the United States, you can drop into the Smithsonian or the British Museum and check out artifacts from these cultures. Are there some islands that where the indigenous groups survive more vividly to this day?
I think that most places are, you know, thoroughly westernized, but there are places where in some parts of Polynesia, for example, people speak the native language. Mm-hmm. So Samoan speak Samoan and Tongan speak Tongan. Mm-hmm. In Hawaii, Hawaiian has had to be brought back, really. And in New Zealand, they're bringing back Maori. And in both of those places, I think they're being quite successful about bringing the languages back. So that's really fantastic.
That's good news. That is really good news. And that's a trend all over the world, is a respect for the smaller languages. They were on a trend to be losing these languages, but now in many regions, the smaller languages are having a renaissance.
I think if there are people willing to do it, they are generally declining still, and it can be pretty hard to bring them back. Yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Christina Thompson. Her latest book is about the settlement of Polynesia. It's called Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia. Christina, in all of your travels and all of your studies, in fact, in your personal life, you married into Polynesia. You've married a Maori man from New Zealand. What is it that you admire about Polynesians? What do you admire most about this culture that inspires you to share this information?
I think that these cultures are just beautiful to me. There's tremendous affection for children. There's a kind of vigor, a love of beauty, a love of dance, a love of sort of, there's a kind of stylishness in a lot of these cultures. I saw a woman not too long ago in Tahiti with the most exquisite hair and flowers, and oh, it's just beautiful. And I think that their deep history is really amazing, that they made these incredible voyages across vast, vast stretches of ocean.
Christina Thompson, author of Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia, thanks for sharing with us your passion for this corner of the world and a fascinating insight into an ongoing adventure to figure out the puzzle of Polynesia.
Thank you.
Sometimes Travel with Rick Steves listeners get inspired to write a haiku poem about what they see and do in their travels. You can send us yours from a link on the radio page of our website at ricksteves.com/radio. We might even read it on the show one day. Here's a few we thought you might enjoy.
Deborah A. Bennett of Carbondale, Illinois, provides a seasonal snapshot from downtown Chicago. Chicago in spring. Ancient river and the trees, all one clover green. Here, too, the lover all the poets sing about, full Chicago moon. Art Paul Schlosser writes what it feels like where he lives in Wisconsin. Friendly, like a gift. Hanging out in Madison, you feel at home. And Katherine Johnston of Spokane, Washington, has fond memories of her time as a student in Florence. Dante whispers, soft. Medici majesty reigns. Duomo spirits rise.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Thanks to GBH Radio in Boston for their help this week. Gretchen Strauch read our listener travel haiku. You can send us yours at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.